Good morning. I guess I didn't have to gavel at this point, but I did. Today is February 17th. It's a wonderful day in Oregon. It's 8:30 in the morning, and this is the Education Subcommittee on Education. Today I am going to open up a public hearing. It's agency overview and public testimony on House Bill 5023. Any opening comments, John, before we start?
Just real quick, co-chair comp, members of the committee. House Bill 5023 includes the health-related licensing boards. There's actually six small boards. We're going to have a pretty full agenda. We're doing the three today and then three more tomorrow. As far as agency presentations and public testimony. Today on your schedule, you'll see Mortuary and Cemetery Board, the Board of Naturopathic Medicine, and Occupational Therapy Licensing Board. All of the material should be on OLIS for you, the LFO presentation, the agency presentation, and then the presentation from Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office.
Thank you. We're going to do something a little out of order because we do have somebody signed up for public testimony this morning, and that is for the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board. And so, Nikki, if you'd come forward, and all of us know what it's like to give testimony and run to three other committee rooms to cover all your bases. So welcome, Nikki.
Thank you. Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon, or OTAO. Very gracious for your indulging me this morning, members of the committee, co-chair Comp, co-chair Monroe. We're just here to say we are so pleased with the operation of this board. The Occupational Therapy Licensing Board has done a fantastic
Nikki, you can slow down.
Job.
Breathe now.
I just have my coffee.
Oh.
They've done a fantastic job. In 2008 and 2010, they actually reduced their fees, and at this point, they're able to up from a quarter-time to a part-time employee here on the board to help 100% I'm 99% satisfaction from the customer survey that you'll see with Felicia, the executive director. He'll preview that for you. And we just wanted to say if they needed a small increase, which they don't, we would likely support it because this board has been so efficient and cost-effective and well-run.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki. And John, somebody asked me yesterday a really important question. They said, why does the Education Subcommittee deal with mortuary boards?
Birth to death.
Co-chair comp, members of the committee, the Education Subcommittee gets a lot of these licensing boards more for a workload issue than anything. As far as balancing between all the other subs and various agencies. So you kind of get a eclectic mix.
Great answer. I told them, I don't know, it's none of your business.
What? Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
There may be another reason. Seems like I've carried a couple of dozen bills in the last few years that dealt with cemeteries and mortuaries and...
Uh-huh.
I think the other members of the Senate figure at my age, I have one foot in the grave, and so it's appropriate for me to deal with those issues.
His nickname on the Senate is Dead Man Walking. Yeah.
And Madam Chair.
Okay. We're going to call a halt to this so we can hear testimony soon.
I just think that it's only appropriate. Most of us believe education is a lifelong endeavor, and so if you start with preschool and go all the way life to end of life, it makes sense because that's what education is. From the time you come to the time you go, education is the most important
thing. Lifelong learning.
So it's obvious that they would be in this committee.
Well, I'll let Representative Barton know that he asked the question.
Okay.
Okay. We're going to have Michelle come forward and Claire Clark. And Claire is our standing angel for every day, so it's wonderful to see you again.
See you.
Yeah, please come up forward. Anybody that you have, Michelle, to work with you. These gentlemen don't have to be so shy.
Yeah.
I'll only pick on it for 10 minutes. And Representative Huffman looks like he's awake this morning. It's taken him 3 weeks to kind of get there, so we'll expect at least one or two questions from him.
Tough ones.
Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Gaines. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. A little nervous now because I think that was a much better presentation on the than I'm about to do, so I'll do my best.
We welcome you back.
Thank you.
You do a good job. Thank you.
Thank you. And are they able to see the... Good morning. The Mortuary and Cemetery Board licenses death care facilities and practitioners. We are one of the health professional regulatory boards in Oregon and one of a handful that actually deals with facilities as well as individual practitioners. The as one of the health professional regulatory boards, we do share a common mission of health, protecting the public health, safety, and welfare. Ours, we approach through effective licensing, compliance and enforcement, public awareness and education, both for our practitioners and outreach to the public in general. There are approximately 63,000 deaths in Oregon each biennium, and so when you talk in terms of a target audience and affected groups, a lot of folks think about the death and death care and the individuals, the decedents, and the care of human remains and proper handling, which is a part of it. Perhaps a bigger part of it is working with often vulnerable populations in the elderly or individuals that are in a moment of grief. And because of the taboos around death care, many folks aren't prepared for making the financial decisions that they're in the moment of doing. So there are a lot of important trends and why regulating this industry and educating the public around this is so important. In the presentation here, I wanted to highlight just a couple of things. This particular year, we've been working really hard on our operations and improving the services that we have, squeezing more out of the budget, and improving some of the key performance indicators that have been below where they should be for a number of years. We've done a lot of automation and streamlining with our board packets and enabling meeting outreach, the ability to attend meetings not from Portland but from anywhere remotely through online services. And we've worked really hard to balance the membership of the board from across the state, geographically as well as other factors for diversity on the board, creating representation for all of the license groups, which is something that we're still working toward. There are some of our license groups that do not yet have a seat at the table. That is something that we look forward to addressing. Education and support, it is perhaps somewhat ironic that we are before this committee because it is one of the areas that we're most focused on because our belief on compliance is that education can do a better job of preventing the issues before they even happen, which is in the best interest of both the practitioners and the families that are involved in that. So a lot of our effort and our redesign, if you will, is to improving the opportunities to use all of our functions from the materials that we send out to the way we do inspections to focus on that education and that openness in partnering with the industry in order to have more effective services for the public. I'm going to skip through most of this, don't worry. The board is comprised of 11 members, which is one of the larger groups. We do have four public members, which is one thing that I'm particularly proud about. We have 5.71 positions right now. The key ask in this budget is to ask for the funding to increase one of our positions from 0.71 to full-time. We are also reclassifying that position to address what has been an increasing trend in needing to do document audits, which are the arrangement contracts and things of financial nature, along with funeral arrangements. And then also we have been working closely with Oregon Health Authority on indigent disposition and the management of that fund. And we've actually entered into an interagency agreement to centralize the support of that fund with the mortuary board. In part because with many of the changes there, the program was distributed among three of their separate departments, which made it very hard to trace and make sure that the level of service for the funeral practitioners that were applying for reimbursement to the fund were getting that in a timely fashion, not through any fault of any one department, but simply when you take something and you break it apart. It's also a very small piece of the overall OHA budget. So that's what the ask is, and it's approximately $22,000 in increase in limitation. There is no fee increase or anything else associated with this. We do have sufficient revenue to cover that, in part because of the fee structure that we have. About half of our fees come from the filing of an initial death record, what used to be called the death certificate. And a portion of that goes to fund this board and those programs, and a portion goes to fund the indigent disposition fund in OHA currently. And the remainder of it comes from our various fees, which I've outlined in the document here. In 2009, the fee was increased. It had previously been 20 years before the fee had been increased, and there was quite a shortage for both programs at that time. When we changed it, we knew that it would probably be a long haul before we changed that one again. And so we are at a higher level of ending balance right now, specifically because we knew it would carry us forward. With the dynamics on the way the budget trends, driven predominantly by personal services costs, increases in health care and related things, that is the inflationary factors are what are driving up our budgets. With the exception of the $22,000 we're asking for, all the other increases are tied only to the natural inflation over time, not increasing our programming. In probably about 2020 is when we would have issues with revenue coverage, and that's when we may consider another fee at that time. In the meantime, we're looking at the distribution of it and how we can do that more effectively. Want to highlight just a little bit more because I'm particularly proud of this fact, so I'll take just a few minutes to highlight what we've been doing this biennium within the context of our existing limitation. One of the reasons that this is possible, to highlight again, I mentioned partnering with OHA to improve that program. We've also worked very closely with other agencies, including our sister boards in this 83300 budget, to do as much as we can to share infrastructure, to share concepts, to reduce costs. If we've developed something that works, to share that at no cost with other boards so that they can make use of those best practices as well. Having that ability and that flexibility as a single agency working with other agencies of all sizes is essential and something that we've been lucky enough to make use of with the group that we're with. Within that, we've done some major overhauls, in part because we've had a lot of changeover. We've had some retirements, some other changes, so we've had to look at the way we're doing things. We've been able to strategically keep positions open, using that limitation to bring in temporary help to really address the problems that we've been having and do a complete operational change. We've redesigned our inspection process. As you'll see in the key results, we've always been around in the 50 to 60 to 65% of being able to get to all the facilities in Oregon. We will complete our physical inspection of facilities by the end of March, which will be the first time we're at 100% in at least a decade. We're pretty proud of that. We've also changed the way we do it in the information, the forms that we're using. We've divided out the physical inspection from the document inspection. That's allowed us to increase the feedback to the practitioners, which would sometimes take several months to go through all of the documents before they would even hear how the facility portion of it went. They're able to get that on the spot and then have that part resolved in a week. So we did it to try to improve customer service as well. I mentioned before the electronic board packet distribution and the online meetings, making use of services within the state such as iLink and some of the others. Again, a low-cost entry to be able to provide a fairly robust service to our stakeholders. On the other side, we have eliminated a case backlog that we've been carrying for a number of years. We did also have the pleasure of closing some very large cases that had numerous scores of complaints from different consumers against practitioners. We've been able to resolve that and closing those out. And we have been working on improving our management data, something that's also very hard for small agencies. And I think you'll see that with some of the other boards as well. We are very specifically looking at outcomes and being able to see the effects of the changes that we're making in order to provide the results that you're looking for. Final piece, policy packages that we have, the one that we've mentioned about increasing the FTE. We do also have two other bills that the agency has introduced. Neither one of them has a fiscal impact. They're a continuation of the work that we've been doing with the community to strategically make changes. The first one is actually education related. It's looking at entry into the program, making sure that we can have opportunities for folks to intern and apprentice everywhere in the state and not have to travel to Portland in order to do that portion of their education. We're also looking at shifting to a competency-based assessment program for our apprenticeship. I'm sure you're familiar with that. It is new. We would be the first state that I'm aware of to make that shift. In many provinces in Canada, they have done that and have had success on that. So the first bill has to do with making those kinds of changes in statute so that we can enable those changes in the educational program. And then the final one is related to our inspection program. It makes a small change that would enable us to add self-inspection, self-audits to the portfolio of inspections that we already do. So not replace it, but add an addition to that. And with that, I'll just end my portion of the presentation. Don't know if you want to go to Wally or...
Well, let's see if we have questions. Senator
Roblin? Yeah, more of a comment. I just want to say that over the years at Marshfield High School, where we have, we're one of two schools that have our own cemetery, so we have the Pioneer Cemetery on our grounds like the University of Oregon does. And over the years, we've worked and our kids have taken on the project, and it's through board and other places you find information. So all of the Civil War headstones have been replaced at the expense of the federal government. Veterans, all of the veterans for the Spanish-American War, all the veterans for the First World War, I think they're on working up to the Second World War. There's not a lot of the older ones, but to find those opportunities to allow kids to figure out a little bit about their history and then to know that there are agencies out there that actually work to preserve these older cemeteries, and it's part of the board's responsibility, is really important. Our kids now understand when epidemics went through the area from the 1850s, because they can see all the graves of young children and so on and so forth, and it gives them a better understanding of the place they live, and it's really rather nice to have it. We've also worked as school clubs for little cemeteries that are up Coos River that were covered with black earth that no one even knew was there except the old timers, and kids have gone in and cleaned those things out and started to help. And again, it's through organizations like this that I think we actually even know where some of these are, because you have a subsection on old cemeteries. And I think it's an important thing for the history of our state and for kids to get engaged in. And so, again, another reason why a mortuary board is a good one to have matched with education. So just thought I'd say that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is not near as fun as Senator Roblin's. What's your ending fund balance and how many months is that?
The ending fund balance is about $900,000, and I believe it ends up being 14.9
months.
Yes. And it is high for two reasons. We are a biennial. We do our licensing once a year, so we need a higher balance to get through the rest of the year. But it is mostly because of the fee increase that we increased high in 2009 because of the 20-year life cycle on the fund.
Follow up?
Yes,
thank
please.
You. And the FTE that you are moving from not quite full-time to full-time, one FTE, that will be absorbed into your ending fund balance?
Yes, ma'am.
And you can sustain that?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Any other questions? And did you want to say anything before Claire does her the governor's budget message?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe and the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ordeman. I'm a fifth-generation funeral director from Albany and represent the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. I just wanted to say that we, as licensees, do completely support the budget request of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I've developed a very healthy respect and relationship between the licensees and the Mortuary Board and staff under Michelle's guidance. The programs, the efficiencies, we've seen a dramatic change in the Mortuary and Cemetery Board under Michelle's guidance, and look forward to working with them very closely in the future. We're in full support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have one question, Michelle, before we go to Claire. I find it interesting. Did you say we have about 63,000 deaths each year?
Each biennium.
Each biennium.
Yes.
Okay. Because I know that there's about 40,000 children born every year, so
right.
I was doing the math, but if it's biennium, then
we're still growing.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that, anyway, yes, thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you. I just wanted to go towards the end there, your agency performance goals. I just wanted to kind of check in. I think it's great to have aspirational goals,
mm-hmm.
But just that your improvement in the first two, which are the significantly lower versus the second two, and your change has been 5% and 1%, but your goal for the next year is 100%. Is that aspirational or realistic?
Chair Comp, Representative Smith-Warner, it is realistic in that for this fiscal year, so ending in June, the second half of the biennium, by the end of March, we will be at 100% for facility inspections. And in investigations, about August, we cleared the backlog and started hitting 100%. So based on that is why I feel that we will maintain that. And we should, with these changes that we've done operationally, be able to then now maintain that into 15-17.
Thank you. Great question. Mm-hmm. Senator Monroe.
This discussion always reminds me of the quote from Mark Twain late in his life when he said, "I endeavor to live my life so that when it comes my time to die, even the undertaker will be sorry."
Well, I have no comeback for that. Claire, do you want to take over?
Right here.
I was hoping the chair could explain that. Can you help?
Well, as Senator Thompson, I'd rather talk about growing pears.
Okay.
And it's one reason why Mark Twain actually, when he wrote his...
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is also why Mark Twain, in writing his autobiography, said it could not be published for 100 years because he didn't want to make those people who loved him think differently of him until 100 years later. Because he chose to be honest in his... Well, as he said, I chose to be as honest as one could be about my life.
Yes, I'd rather read Shakespeare.
Oh, he's a great writer.
Okay, Claire, I don't know. I started this morning. I don't know where I lost it. But.
Good morning.
All right. Well, this should seem familiar. Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Claire Clark. I'm from the Chief Financial Office. So this morning, I will give a brief presentation on the governor's budget for the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. So the governor's budget for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board provides resources to continue current services and ensure the efficient administration of the Indigent Disposition Fund. The board is situated within the public safety outcome area of the 10-year plan for Oregon. It provides consumer protections for potentially vulnerable grieving individuals, protecting them from deceptive practices or unsafe services. The board also works to promote disaster preparedness and resiliency by coordinating with local and federal agencies for emergency preparedness. So here you can see the brief history of the board's expenditures and FTE from 2011-13 to 2015-17. For the 2013-15 biennium, the legislature approved inflationary increase, but otherwise did not make any changes to the board's budget. For the 2015-17 governor's budget, the budget is $1.6 million, which is a 7.4% increase from the 2013-15 legislatively approved budget. The 2015-17 budget includes the reclassification of one existing permanent office specialist position to administrative specialist, and it increases the FTE of that position, as Michelle has mentioned, from 0.71 FTE to full-time. So at this new classification, the person in this position will be able to perform the auditing and document review necessary to effectively administer the Indigent Disposition Fund. This chart displays the revenues for the board over time. Again, this board is 100% other funds. It receives about 35% of its revenues from annual licensing and renewal fees charged to those engaged in certain death care activities. This revenue is displayed on the chart in blue. About 60% of the board's revenues come from a $14 portion of the $20 death registration, death registration filing fee, which is transferred to the board from the Oregon Health Authority. So these revenues are displayed in the chart in green. You can see that there's an increase in the board's revenue from 2009-11, starting with the 2009-11 biennium, which is the increase in the death certificate filing fee. It was anticipated when this fee was raised that the board would have a large ending balance, but that it would draw on this ending balance for approximately 10 years to maintain its services. So for the 2015-17 budget, it leaves the board with approximately $966,000 in ending balance, which is equal to about 15 months of operating expenses.
Just to make clear, sure. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. So the $14 of the $20 registration, death registration fee, is that a filing fee, or is it each of those death certificates we get copies of, you multiply that number by that 14? How does that work? Is that one time for the filing of that death certificate or the copies of the death certificate?
I'll let you go ahead.
Chair Comp, Representative Springer, it is the one time only for the initial filing.
Thank you.
Thank you. So just to summarize, the governor's budget for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board supports current services and makes investments to ensure the effective administration of the Indigent Disposition Fund. It reclassifies one position from office specialist to administrative specialist and increases that position to full-time. So that is everything for me today, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Claire. Any questions? Representative Smith-Warner.
Sorry, I have a quick question, and I'm not sure. It's probably for you and not for you, Claire. Okay. Sorry. Just going back to the inspection, the way you've separated them out, has that impacted the kind of staffing level? Because it sounds like if you're able to separate them out and you can now get through all of the facilities in the biennium, it sounds like before it was the paperwork part that was making that more difficult. So has there been a corresponding kind of change in responsibilities for who's doing the physical inspections and who's doing the paperwork inspections?
I'm gonna.
And does that impact kind of this rearranging of staffing?
Yeah. Chair Comp, Representative Smith-Warner.
Hard to see over here.
I know. Got to shift over here so I can get to the microphone. We did a number of things in trying to streamline the inspections. We are
repurposing essentially this position. It had come open, and then we had brought on a temp individual to focus on the document side of it, so that the individual who had been going out into the field could focus predominantly, almost exclusively, on doing the physical inspection portion of it. We streamlined the forms and the materials that they would use, and so that's how we would do that. That's why we want to reclass this position permanently in order to support that program.
Thank you.
Senator Roldman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is the Indigent Disposal Fund, is that the group that's now more responsible for the issue we had at the state hospital a few years ago that our Senate president was actively engaged in, and then also the incidents that have happened in the past 30 years that we had in certain mortuaries where they found undisposed of people? Is that the group that follows that the most, or is it the investigation part? Does the individual mortuaries and the Indigent Fund helps with both the state hospital and other people that don't have resources?
Right. Chair Comp, Senator Roblin, it is the latter. Our board and these inspections that we do and the regulatory oversight that we have as a result of those issues about 30 years ago in Newport. Yeah. So we have that regulatory oversight. The indigent program that's currently in the Oregon Health Authority, it's an interesting split. They oversee the fund that funeral practitioners can apply to, and statutorily there's certain criteria for when they can do that. The enforcement side of the practitioners applying to that fund or any issues that there may be is with the regulatory oversight is with this board. So it's a shared focus on that. And then, yes, so it's a blend of issues such as the state hospital or other concerns that there have been about indigent remains.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other thoughts or questions? Thank you for your great work. Several years ago, some of these questions weren't as easily answered, and we appreciate all the guidance that you've given to this sensitive subject.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Board of Naturopathic Medicine, Ann Walsh and Sarah, if you'd come forward. And as always, you'll find these slides on OLIS. It might take you a moment to find them, but they're there.
Good morning, co-chairs Comp and Monroe.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, my name is Ann Walsh. I'm the executive director for the Board of Naturopathic Medicine. With me is Sarah Gucci, ND. She's a ND board member as well as a natural child care support person for the board. And then you know Claire. The board of naturopathic mission is to protect the public by providing education, licensing, and regulation to naturopathic physicians in the state of Oregon. The board was established in 1927. I'm really nervous. I've done this before, and I should be more relaxed, but I'm always nervous.
Yes, that's just because we've been acting silly.
A good joke would help.
Anyway. I don't have one. Did you have one, Representative Smith-Warner? Oh.
Anyway, the board was established by the 1927 legislature, and there are 7 board members, 5 naturopathic physician members, and 2 public members that are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Their terms are 3 years each. The board's authority is found in Oregon Revised Statute, Chapter 685, and Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 850. The board actually only has one very important program, and that is the public protection of persons obtaining naturopathic medical care in Oregon. We have 3 key performance measures in public safety, timely investigations, customer satisfaction, and best practices. The number of licensees continues to grow. In 2000, we were close to about 250 licensees. In January of 2015, it's closer to 1,100. So there's definitely a need for naturopathic primary care in the state of Oregon, and it's becoming more apparent and becoming more available, both through the schools and through insurance providers being more accepting of the practice. There are 30, the board also issues a certification in natural childbirth, and we have 30 practitioners who specialize in that. Sarah is one of them. So as the profession grows, inevitably the number of complaints will be increased as well. In 2007, we had approximately 17 complaints that were investigated. There were probably more complaints than that, but at that time is when I actually started tracking the ones that we went further on, as opposed to I track all of them at this point. In 2008, we started a criminal background check on new applicants. So that number of complaints increased, because as you do a background check on somebody, it's their responsibility to fully disclose anything that's happened in their past. But we have to compare that, have somebody do the comparison with the FBI check to what they have disclosed, and contact them and investigate what's fact and what's not fact, and make sure that we are licensing appropriately. The board is looking to start doing LEDS checks only on renewals. We have not done that in the past, and that is the December meeting that vote was taken to start doing that. It's an important part for the safety of the public. So I could go in on more about the complaints. Like in 2013, we had approximately 38 complaints. And of those, 10 of them, the main areas of concern have been prescribing, especially with the problem of drug addiction and pain management that is becoming more prevalent in society. The board was seeing more complaints on the prescribing issues. And then another chunk of them are the background checks, are not problematic so much as they need to be investigated and make sure that the applicant's appropriately licensed. And then in 2014, we had 42 complaints, excuse me. About 8 of those were regarding the prescribing, over-prescribing issues, and 10 of them were on the background checks. From the 2013, we have one case that's still pending, and we had 2 that we actually issued a discipline on, restricting their prescribing practices for their well-being as well as their patient's well-being. In 2014, we issued restrictive discipline on one of the prescribing cases and one of the background checks. We didn't restrict his practice or the practice so much as just wanted to put a probationary cover over them so that we could watch them for a few years to make sure that they understood that their past could be problematic if they aren't paying attention to how they practice. The board's administration is conducted out of the state-owned building in Portland. That is the same building that there are 6 other agencies share. We, the naturopathic board, cohabitates in a suite with 4 other agencies, licensing agencies. So we share a lot of IT, we share computer support, we share with both mortuary and medical imaging, who are in different suites. We share a lot of IT support. We all meet monthly to talk about concerns that we share as small agencies and the best practices in resolving those concerns so that we are saving time and resources and doing things like that. The board's administration is done by 2.5 FT at this time. There's myself, I have an administrative assistant, and a half-time investigator. our funding wasn't viable for a package that I had originally proposed to increase the half-time investigator to full-time investigator for this biennium, but we are looking at the 2017-2019 because we may need to increase fees anyway for some legislation that's potentially pending that may change that our structure as well. We have one bill, Senate Bill 281, would amend ORS 685-160 to assure that newly appointed board members can serve two full consecutive terms. Currently, a newly appointed member finishes out the term of an outgoing or vacated position, so they end up losing part of a term by doing that. It should not be a problem to get that passed, I don't think. Some of the proactive actions the board is working on, and Sarah is a part of this in a big way. She's her term will be up in June of this year, and I'm not very thrilled with that, but she's been working with two other board members to work with the school that's located in Portland to offer a class, and they're going to be doing that in May, to educate those who are graduating and those who are the students at the school on what licensing means and what their responsibilities will be and how to move forward and practice safely. Another thing that we are doing, and Sarah is also working on that, is we're trying to establish a mentorship type of program for board members. So an outgoing board member will commit to a year to the new board member as a resource for process and understanding to make that transition and help them become a better board member in a shorter period of time. And what was there, one other thing it seems like? Then just the LEDS check. We feel like that's another really positive move towards the licensing. You can share that in a minute.
Okay. I was going to say, Senator Roland.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to know if you have been engaged as we've gone to this new health program with CCOs with the acceptance of naturopathic providers within that system.
Co-chairs and Senator Roblin, the board is not, that's a professional association has moved forward with that, and yes, they are being very proactive in getting naturopathic physicians. Sarah may be able to address that more because she works with it in her practice, or not.
No problem. I have been engaged in a few of those issues over time, so I think it's important for people to have options, and I encourage you to continue to work to make that work.
Thank you.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. Thank you for being here today. I was just wondering, is there any kind of correlation between the folks that you're receiving complaints about now, naturopath physicians who are receiving complaints about now, and information that you learned in the background checks? Are those? There's no.
Co-Chair Comp and Monroe and Representative Taylor. No, there's actually not. What we're finding in the background checked is often very minor things. A DUI in college from a party or protesting or an environmental issue. And then sometimes they just get involved in, not involved, but their intent is to help their patients. And I think that sometimes it just gets out of hand, the patient gets in charge and the doctor forgets, and that's what we try to help them get back to when we discipline a doctor.
Follow-up?
It's educational.
Yes, follow-up.
Perhaps I should know this, but I guess I don't. Do naturopath physicians have the same prescribing rights as a medical doctor?
Chair and Representative, yes, they do. There are a few restrictions.
Explain that it's changed, and that's why.
Yeah, it has changed. In 2009, their prescribing authority was opened to include almost everything. And that's why some of the doctors were getting patients who, often a drug seeker looking for help and when you believe your patient, it just starts snowballing on you sometimes.
Follow-up?
Yes, please continue.
So has your board taken steps to make certain that naturopath physicians are well trained now to understand, now that they've been given this new authority and perhaps they'd already been out of school?
I'm just trying to make certain
that this risk is being addressed now before the problem escalates.
In the fall of 2013, when the board realized that the predominant number of cases were coming forward were prescription problems, we immediately started working with the professional association to educate doctors. There was no harm in their prescribing, but they were basically, it was just a concern with the number of prescriptions that were being written, to educate doctors on how to know your patient when they come in to be able to tell a drug seeker from somebody who's got true pain or from somebody who's addicted as opposed to somebody who's just, has a chronic pain issue that they're dealing with. So in 2013, we started working with them, and in June of 2014, they put on a full-day presentation that brought in medical doctors, psychologists, who all spoke to those that attended on how you best help your patient, how you learn about them when they come in the door to prevent these kind of issues. Additionally, the board has two board members and a formulary council member who are working since June of 2014 to establish some kind of a policy to put in place for opioid prescribing for naturopathic physicians. They have gone to conferences, they're using other resources, and what we're hoping they will do by the fall of 2015 is have some kind of a policy in place that will be a guideline for doctors who choose to take on pain patients, and so that they have a better understanding of what their responsibility is and how they can best treat these patients.
Follow up, please. Thank you. I know this must be a trying time for your board to get through this, and I appreciate that you're taking it. It sounds like you're taking it seriously. It's a serious issue. And so I have a two-part question, and one is, was that training mandatory for your naturopath physicians, and if not, will it be a requirement that they receive this training to be aware of this potential
co-chairs
problem?
Rep Taylor, the board did discuss that and decided not to mandate it because most naturopaths don't prescribe any controlled substances, and most aren't dealing with this issue of the pain patient. When they're coming in, they're referring them out, mm-hmm. as opposed to those who do choose to do prescriptions, and then they are the ones that they have to be responsible for themselves at some mm-hmm. point.
And I just have one final question. I'm so sorry to ask so many questions. The last question is the naturopath physicians working with the pharmacy board so that I understand, this is just what I understand, is that pharmacists and pharmacies with technology, they keep track of when prescriptions are coming in that are ordered by doctors, medical doctors, so that they can track and identify medical doctors who are perhaps over-prescribing, I believe is the term used. And so is that also being done regarding naturopaths so that we can track and identify a naturopath physician who's perhaps engaging in that?
Yes.
Be doing it intentionally. But
right. There's a prescription drug monitoring program, which is state-funded or mm-hmm. state-run.
And the naturopath physicians are part of that.
Are part of that. And so even a naturopath who does not prescribe can go to that site and look up a patient and find out what that patient's prior prescription history is. So that gives them, even if they don't prescribe to that patient, they can know their history so they know how to best treat that patient going forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I apologize if I missed something that would give me greater understanding while I was out of the room. But Representative Taylor brings up a great point. And frankly, I might reveal how much I don't know. And I don't know that I apologize for that because we don't know everything, but
that's good to know.
my friends that have seen naturopathic physicians don't go to a naturopathic physician for drugs.
Right.
They don't go. So I'm seeing a real disconnect here of why you would make this choice and then, excuse me, why you would make this choice and then in that choice ask for a narcotic level pain medication. That comes from the regular primary
physician.
I'm going
to, if it's okay, defer this question to Dr. Oguchi, who's a naturopathic physician sitting right here.
Good morning, Representative Comp, Representative Monroe, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Oguchi. I'm a naturopathic physician, and I've been serving the board, the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine, for over 5 years now, during which time there's been a huge, as Ann mentioned, first off, I want to mention that since Ann has been serving the board since 1998, I became licensed in 2000. I think she mentioned the growth from 250 of us in 2000 when I graduated to now 1,100. That's a huge, huge change, and I feel like Anne has done a fantastic job trying to navigate those huge changes. And as she mentioned, the change in our formulary from being relatively narrow to being able to prescribe anything, as we are considered primary care physicians in the state of Oregon. One of the ways that we've been able to expand and serve more people, there's a shortage of physicians in rural areas, and so there have been increasing numbers of naturopathic physicians who have gone to those areas, and I think that's where they've gotten into trouble, because as we've in the board, we've called it nicitis. We're trained to really listen to people and be compassionate. We have the we often get to spend more time with patients than medical doctors do. So,
Doctor, you're real close to the microphone.
Okay.
And we're hearing feedback.
You can step
Sorry.
Back. You can stand back.
Okay.
They're very sensitive.
Thanks. So particularly, it seems like particularly in rural areas, there have been doctors who, because there are so few places they can, because there are so few medical providers, they have very few people they can send people to, and so they end up as primary care. Some of them have been sort of sucked into, I guess you could say, continuing the medical medications that patients were previously on. The doctors left or something like that, and those are the kinds of cases that we've been seeing. So on myself, I practice in Portland. There are plenty of people I can refer to. I have a DEA license. I prescribe those medications maybe twice a year for very short-term kinds of situations, and I would say that by far and away the majority of naturopathic physicians are, we don't want to prescribe most things. That's not what we're trained to do. We do, when the formulary was expanded, we did get an additional, we do 50 hours of continuing education every year, and 20 of those hours now have to be in related to pharmaceuticals. So that's where hopefully those of us that are prescribing those medications are taking additional focused training on using them correctly. And that's why some of us on the board are going to speak at the school and grand rounds to the graduating docs to remind them of some of these important issues. And there will continue to be continuing education opportunities with these focuses.
First of all, thank you so much for coming. Oh, thank you, Chair Comp. Thank you so much for coming. And we know we try to make everyone feel comfortable when they come in, and we know it's a little nerve-wracking. So I just want you to know we really appreciate and respect the work that you do. Ms. Walsh, can you confirm whether or not what she said is true? Is this an issue that you're seeing more in the rural areas than in the urban areas? Not to refute, I was just wondering if you have some sort of data on that.
Co-chair and Representative Taylor, yes, there is the doctors who have been disciplined, who have in actuality most given up their DEA registration, have been in rural areas. Okay. And what their intent has been is to have a patient who comes to them who's on heavy drugs for whatever pain they perceive to to have as a patient, and help them get off those drugs, and by lifestyle changes, by dietary changes, by
acupuncture,
you know, other alternatives, acupuncture, herbs, whatever. And then when you have somebody who's a chronic, either has seriously chronic pain or serious drug addiction issues, they are the best liars. And they, when you are a doctor, you really want to help them, and so you, that's how they end up in trouble, is not being able to read that patient well enough to know that they can't help them. Another issue in the rural area is what happened. We had two doctors in very close proximity. Was there was a medical doctor who had been taking care of all of these pain patients who lost his license completely. So that left all of these people with nowhere to go for their pain, because there are no pain clinics, there are no opportunities for alternative help out in those rural areas. And that is what we are seeing is where's the main problem lies.
Follow up, Chair Kump. Thank you. How many states have the level of licensure that allows them to prescribe the full, sounds like the full breadth of drugs? How many states allow naturopath physicians to prescribe at the level that we allow in Oregon?
I'm thinking off the top of my head, there's four currently that do that. Okay. Not all states currently license naturopathic right. physicians.
Okay, thank
so
you.
That's part of the problem.
Thank you. And doctor, did you have any comments? Because our time is moving along. And, okay,
I don't think so.
Claire, can you give us your summary? Thank you for sharing and all your work.
Welcome.
Julie, do you mind pulling up the screen? Can you press escape for me?
Pardon?
Can you press escape for me?
Escape?
Yes. Thank you. All right, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Claire Clark, and I'm from the Chief Financial Office. I have a very short presentation for you on the governor's budget for the Board of Naturopathic Medicine. The 2015 governor's budget for the Board of Naturopathic Medicine continues services at the current level and maintains the board's current fee structure as approved by the 2011 legislature. The Board of Naturopathic Medicine is also situated within the public safety outcome area of the 10-year plan for Oregon. It provides consumer protections for Oregonians by setting standards for licensure aimed at ensuring patients receive quality services. So again, here's a brief history of the expenditures for the board from 2011-13 to 2015-17 governor's budget. Even though in this chart it shows that the FTE has remained stable, I'd like to point out that in 2013, the legislature made permanent a half-time investigator position, which they had added in the 2011-9 biennium. The 2015-17 budget leaves an ending balance. I skipped a line. For 2015-17, the governor's budget is approximately $700,000, which is a 7.8% increase from the 2015-17 legislatively approved budget. The 2015-17 budget leaves an ending balance of approximately $224,000, which is equal to over 7 months of operating expenses. And this board, for cash flow purposes, needs about 6 months of ending balance due to its license renewal cycle. And actually, that is everything I have for you today. And if you have any questions, I would welcome those.
Yes. Questions for Claire? Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. And hope you were able to calm down. You did great.
I did. Thank you so much.
Yes. And we do only have about 20 minutes left to committee, so we're going to have the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, Felicia Holgate and Robert Bond.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
We will be short. My name is Felicia Holgate, and I'm the director of the board and have been executive director for 11 years. And with me today is Robert Bond, Bob Bond, who is our board chair and a public member, and he's in his seventh year. We have four-year terms. Our programs are licensing and investigations to make sure that we provide safe and ethical delivery of occupational therapy services in the state. The board was started licensing in 1977 with a few hundred licenses. When I came on in 2013, we were at 12,000. To explain just briefly some things that happened right before I came on the board. There was a dip in the licensing number, so the board saw the numbers going down, and they had a very difficult discipline case that was costing a lot of money and a lot of concern on the part of the board of how much one case can cost. So at that time, right before I came on, the board increased the fees, and right after I came on, I was fortunate. We kept our discipline fairly steady, and our license numbers continued to grow, and by next year, I expect that to be, we're over 2,000 licensees now, and we'll probably have 2,200 by the end of the, or 2,100 and something by the end of this biennium. So by next biennium, I think it'll double since I've been working. We have five board members, two occupational therapists, one occupational therapy assistant, and our two public members have been very active. We appreciate all of Bob's hard work. The numbers, as I said, license numbers have grown a lot. Occupational therapy is considered to be one of the fastest growing professions that Oregon has, and nationally that we have. The complaints when I started were very few. We're talking about one or two, sometimes none, that we had to consider. That number for us has grown. We had 17 cases this last year. And I think we have some pretty good idea about why they've grown even that much. But let me go back to our performance measures and start with our first one, which is timely licensing. We do license within 2 or 3 days, and we've been able to do that. We started online licensing already. We've done it 4 times already. We do 2-year licensing. And the work that we do has become much easier because of online renewals and all the work we do. When I started, I think we were about 80% paper, and now we're maybe 5% paper, as most of us know. So with our timely licensing, we do check education, and we do check the verification from any state where that licensee worked, as well as the National Certification Board. And they also report back as a primary source to us. Two improvements that we've made. We started an online Oregon Law Ethics exam that's very easy to do at no cost to the licensee, and I just get an email when the results come in. They can take it over if they need to. and they have to pass it before we issue the license. And we also have worked with the nursing board to do our law, LEDS checks. The law enforcement data system, because we're so small, we have a contract with them, and they do that for us. And we plan to do that every renewal, so I'll be doing it again in the spring. I think some of the things we do very well that have been mentioned is we coexist with the other boards and we really help each other out, not only with things like IT and sharing the copier and the fax, and all those costs add up and we're able to divide them up with our other boards. We also share administrative functions. If we have a case that we're wondering about, we talk to each other and help each other out. I also use an iPhone and a laptop, so I'm able to this morning forward my work to my assistant, and when I come in later, she'll have a lot of that work already done. We have a laptop, so if I'm away, I can actually keep up. We work closely with the association and the schools. The other thing that happened just before I came was with the drop in licensing, and it had some to do with Medicare changes where there weren't as many jobs. And so when the OT assistant school closed at Mount Hood Community College, there was about 8 years or 10 years where there was no OT assistant school, and now we have the new one at Lynn Benton Community College. So that has added, increased our OT assistance also in the state. We work closely with the association and the schools. I go, and Bob has come with me a number of times. We talk to the students ahead of time about what their responsibilities, what to expect, how to get licensed, how to get a limited permit, and we're in close contact with them. We also do presentations in front of the association every year, and we have focused on education. For example, we did a presentation where we looked at the typical kinds of complaints, and we made them be the board members, and we'd say, here's a hypothetical case. Here's what you can do. What would you do? And then added questions. And if this happened, what would your decision? Just to make it that these are our board members are just like them, and they're making decisions to protect the public. And I think those have been very effective. The other thing that has happened is the legislature has put in mandatory reporting. So any therapist has to report an arrest for a conviction for a misdemeanor or an arrest for a conviction within 10 days. And we actually find that there's most of our cases and investigations are self-reported. We also find that there seem to be a lot of investigations we have with new applicants that have come in that have had either crimes or discipline from another state. So if an applicant comes in and they've been under probation by another state, we don't want to just give them a license. We have to check what happened in the other state and then perhaps set up the same type of probation in Oregon for them to work. So we do talk about trends and what to avoid so they stay out of trouble, and what are typical cases that the board has quite a bit, not only in person but also with in our newsletter and on our website. So because we have very few discipline, the board looks at every case each time. Each board meeting we follow through. Sometimes our cases go on for years, but that's because if we have an applicant that's on probation with conditions, we keep that as an open case until it's closed. So we may have an occupational therapist that's on probation for as long as they're on a court DUI probation, and we may ask for several things to get the reports from the probation officer that they're following through, any other requirements that the court may have. But we also might ask that they be under closer supervision by their supervisor, and then we get quarterly reports from their supervisor at work to make sure there's no issues going on. So those cases may stay on as a probationary case for 2 years, whereas the decision was already made 6 months ago. We expect a certain amount of increase in investigations and discipline just because our numbers have grown so much, and again, because of mandatory and self-reporting. I think we do our education and our outreach really well. The other big thing I think we've been able to keep our costs down is because all of our cases have been resolved by consent orders. And we have not had any cases go to trial in an administrative hearing. We just had a case that we settled the week before a 2-day hearing was set. And that would have cost us a lot of money. And we already had spent almost $8,000 in attorney fees just during the process of getting it ready for the hearing. It was settled. So those are the big costs, really, for any board, is the investigations and the attorney costs. And because we have consent order where we have the findings of fact, the conclusions of law, and what the discipline that the board considers appropriate and that the licensee agrees to, that's a huge savings for us. Our customer satisfaction rates are very high, and they appreciate the work that we do. Best practice requirements of the board are looked at every year and taken seriously. The board looks at things like our monthly accounting and all of our payments that are made on a monthly basis, and have those for review at each of our quarterly meetings. As was discussed, we were able to reduce the fees in the past. This biennium, or the coming biennium, we are not asking for a fee increase, but I can see that that might well be required in the future because we now have I have a part-time person that may need to increase, and also all the investigations have been done either by me or a contract occupational therapist that was on the board and is excellent. She's our board consultant. But as the numbers grow, there might need to be a more permanent person for that. I think our big changes that we've done this year is we've written rules on telehealth and on OTs working in behavioral and mental health, an area of practice that not that many people know that OTs do. We do answer a lot of questions on scope of practice, and we have a good Q&A as well as a fast response to licensees. We have no specific issues at all this year. We appreciate Claire's work, and our budget is ready to go. We ask that you approve the governor's budget. And I don't know if Bob Bond might want to say a few words or if you have any questions.
We have one question, Representative Springer and then Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. What's your ending fund balance?
It's Chairs Comp and Senator Monroe and Representative Springer, it's almost $300,000.
And how many months operating is that?
9 or 10 months. And we do renewals every other year.
Okay.
So we'll be doing the next renewals starting in March of 2016.
Go ahead.
And we've got Claire here for a comment.
Good morning. For the record, this is Claire Clark again. To address your question, Representative Springer, I think the Felicia may have
transpose the 13-15 ending balance with the 15-17 ending balance. So for the 13-15 ending balance, it looks to be about $300,000. But for the 15-17 biennium, it's $169,000, which is, it is also equal to
169.
Thank you.
Follow-up,
yes, sorry,
please.
I was looking
yes,
at the
and
follow-up.
Thank you for that. And then you said you're anticipating a fee increase, most likely. And second part to that, right, not now, but in the future. Mm-hmm. Second part of that is you were also looking at increasing the FTE to a, I don't know if it'd be a full-time equivalent or not, the FTE of the assistant. So how does that factor into your funding, ending fund balances with or without a fee increase?
Well, we don't need anything for the 15-17.
Right.
We're fine on that. And right. Yes, the almost 300,000 was for this biennium, and that's why we don't need a fee increase in the next biennium. I don't anticipate going from half-time to full-time. I think it'll be a very gradual amount. And the investigator, if we can have a good personal services contract with an occupational therapist, that has worked very well because the issues that are OT related. I don't think it'll all happen at once. I'm just saying that that's where I see the need will, because with the increase in licensees, there'll be an increase in issues that come up. It's hard to tell right now, but we're fine for the next biennium. I'm just saying in the future that might happen. But as the association said, even if we do need an increase, they're appreciative how careful we are in keeping our costs down. And I've done as much of that work as I can to keep the investigative parts down.
Thank you.
Representative Porter.
I just wanted to comment that in your submitted testimony, your first two pages are summary. The first two pages are summary, and then the rest of it is a very well laid out presentation on all sorts of data about your licensees. And I wanted to mention for the record, a number of boards that have come before us already have talked about the upcoming burden of Senate Bill 320 or 230, which will require boards to collect demographic data from licensees. And I just wanted to point out that clearly this is something that your board is already doing, and from the presentation, it seems very well done. So I wanted to see if you had any comment on why, were you guys just trying to get out ahead of the curve? How do you do this, et cetera?
Okay. Co-chairs Compton Monroe and Representative Warner. When the issue came up a number of years ago, several of the boards agreed to start looking at it. And so, yes, we did get into it on a voluntary basis. When it first started, though, I have to admit that we were being told that we may get some help to collect the data, and that didn't happen. And in fact, there's, by rule, a $5 per licensee cost. And so I added those just so you could see. We've been able to pay those costs with our ending balance money basically as a revenue transfer and have not charged licensees. Some of the other boards have tacked on the $5, and we may need to do that sometime in the future. It, you know, it's hard to predict 3 years ahead, but yes, we were one of the boards that agreed to work on that.
Follow up.
Yes,
so
please.
So is the $5 fee what you are being charged by your vendor for collecting and then sorting that data?
No. Co-chairs Compton Monroe and Representative Warner. No. The $5 fee is what we're charged from the Oregon Health Authority for their putting up the statistics. The cost for us of setting up the IT, we actually, when somebody goes online to renew, they have to go into the website, fill out all of the questions, and then complete their renewal. So the $5 fee doesn't come to us at all. It goes to the cost of the Oregon Health Authority for that data collection and putting it together.
Because you're the one. This is the first time I've seen this in anybody's. So I'll be interested to see who else is already doing this, because it looks like great information that I have to imagine is helpful for you guys.
Sometimes. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we've collect other data already, but not in this format. I believe that of our boards, I think we're the only ones of the 833 agencies that already have the data.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Because time is very short, Board Member Bond, do you have a comment before Claire closes this up with a final statement?
No, nothing additional. I thank you very much for allowing us to come, but I really, we have a very, very competent executive director, and I think she covered things quite well.
Well, I've learned it takes a whole team to make something like this effective, so thank you for your service.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Okay, Claire, you have 2 minutes.
Okay. I think that's where I timed it this morning. Co-Chairs Monroe and Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Claire Clark. I'm from the Chief Financial Office. I need to bring my presentation up still. So this morning I'll give a brief presentation on the governor's budget for the Occupational Therapy Board. The 2015 governor's budget for the Occupational Therapy Board continues service at the current level and adjusts administrative staff to accommodate the growth in the board's licensing workload. So here you can see the board's revenues from 2011-13 to 2015-17. For the 2013-15 biennium, the legislature approved inflationary increases, but otherwise did not change the agency's budget. For 2015-17, the governor's budget for the board is $458,452, which is an increase of 20.6% from the 2013-15 legislatively approved budget. The 2015-17 budget also includes the reclassification of an office specialist position to an administrative specialist position and increases the FTE for that position from 0.25 to 0.5 FTE. Again, this is to accommodate the increased workload in licensing that has resulted from the growing licensee base. The 2015-17 budget leaves an ending balance of approximately $169,000, which is equal to about 9 months of operating expenses. And this is about right for the board because they need about 8 months of ending balance due to their licensing renewal cycle. And that's everything from me today.
Any questions for Claire? Senator Roblin.
Yeah, just a comment. I really do appreciate the Bandon's Lighthouse every time she does her presentation, and I want to make sure that just north of there is a nice little resort. On weather lately has been between 70 and 65 degrees and no wind. So for those that are listening to the broadcast, it's really nice to do some district advertising.
I'm so glad we had that brief public announcement. And with that, thank you for your presentation. John, tomorrow who will we hear from?
Chair Comp, members of the committee, tomorrow we'll continue with the boards for the House Bill 5023. We'll hear from the Medical Imaging Board, the Speech Language Pathology and Audiology Board, and the Veterinary Medical Examining Board.
Oh, we do need to have possibly Senator Girard about the Veterinary Board. He was always interested in that, but have him as a guest. I'm joking.
And Madam Chair, tomorrow at 10 o'clock, the new governor's being sworn in.
Right.
So we may want to get finished here a little earlier than normal.
That would be helpful, because I know you can do it.
Yeah.
We are, did anybody have, Smith, Arnie, you have a?
I was just going to say that I had heard that 9:30 was the request for us to be on the floor.
Oh.
So that may be a significant schedule change for tomorrow.
Well, you'll find throughout the session this committee is very adaptable. So We'll take care of it. Thank you. We are adjourned. Adjourned. Care of it. Thank you. We are.